a customer that comes to you and says, I want a 1,000 horsepower car, really is telling you, I want a fast car that I like to get in and go and drive. You know, unless they are just trying to flex for the gram or whatever.
Welcome to the HPA Tuned In podcast. I'm Andre, your host. And in this episode, we're chatting with Reed from Kaizen Speed and KS Tuned, also the creator of the relatively new Kaizen Relay, which we're going to find out about when we get into this interview. Now, I've personally known Reed for probably about 10 years now. We met him fairly early on in the HPA journey, which was really fortunate. We were also lucky enough, Ben and I, were actually hosted on what was then his podcast, which we'll talk a little bit more about as we go through the chat with him. That was the Do It For A Living podcast. And we will also drop into the show notes a link so you can listen to that episode as well if you want. Reed is your typical automotive enthusiast, and we find out how he actually got started working on cars and how he built that passion into what has become a fairly successful business. Reed also is an entrepreneur at heart, and you can tell as we go through this interview talking to Reed how passionate he is about creating new products. And I think that really separates him from a lot of the other workshops out there which are focused more on the service industry. Absolutely nothing wrong with that, of course, but you can tell talking to Reed how he's always looking for that next idea, that next innovation. And particularly for me, it was really interesting talking about the Kaizen Relay, the process of reinventing something that most of us take for granted, the old-fashioned mechanical relay, and turning that into something modern that sits between the much more expensive power distribution modules that are now becoming pretty much the norm in higher-end builds, but they're definitely out of reach for a lot of budget-conscious enthusiasts. But of course, you know, there's got to be something in between the PDM and the mechanical relay, which is not without its reliability problems. That's where the Kaizen Relay comes in. A lot of cool features packed into that as well, in particular the ability to control that via CAN messaging. But I won't spoil the surprise. We'll jump into that as we get further into the interview. Also really interesting, I found the chat we had with Reed here about standalone engine management versus reflashing. He does a lot of both, and this is something we often get asked. What should I choose for my particular build? Is reflashing correct? Is a standalone the only way to go? So really interesting conversation getting Reed's take on exactly that. Now, before we get into the interview, for those who are new to High Performance Academy, we are an online training school and not just a podcast. And we specialize in teaching people how to tune. We specialize in teaching people how to build performance engines, construct wiring harnesses, to learn how to drive faster on a racetrack, and also to optimize their race cars when they're out on the track. Now, we do all of this with video-based training courses that you can take from the comfort of your own place. There is no need to travel to us, no cost involved in traveling in order to learn. You can learn from the comfort of your lounge suite. You can check out our entire back catalog of courses by heading to hpacademy.com/courses. Now, just given the conversation that we had today, there's a couple of courses that I think really suit quite nicely the conversation, and this is around tuning. Learning how to tune was difficult, particularly Reed and I probably got involved in the industry around about the same time. We didn't have the benefit of the wide range of information that's now available out on the internet. Certainly didn't have the benefit of the courses that we're now producing. And these are really set up to fast track your tuning progress and help you avoid those costly and time consuming mistakes. So two courses that I'd suggest here if you are interested in learning more. We have our practical standalone tuning course, which, as its name implies, will teach you how to tune an aftermarket standalone ECU. Doesn't matter what brand you're personally interested in, could be Motec, Haltech, AEM, Link, it is applicable irrespective. There's a nice, simple 10-step process that you can apply to your own tuning. And what that does is it breaks the entire process down, which on face value might seem overwhelming and daunting. And when you break it down into 10 bite-sized steps, each of those steps is quick and easy to apply. In no time, you've got to the end. You've got a properly tuned engine delivering great power, torque, but most importantly,
great reliability. Now, once you've learned the basics of that 10-step process and how to apply it, you can then watch our worked examples. And that's where we dive into a specific vehicle on a specific tuning platform. We vary the car and the ECU we're tuning to give you experience on a wide range of different platforms. On top of that, we've also got our practical reflash tuning course, the other topic we talk about today. We'll teach you how to reflash a factory engine management system. Very similar to everything I just talked about, it's applicable irrespective of what car or reflashing software you're using, but a nice simple 6-step process involved there. And again, a really thorough library of worked examples to give you a huge range of experience. I should mention here as well, with all of our courses, they do come with a 60-day money-back guarantee. No questions asked. So if you purchase a course and for any reason at all, you decide, nah, this just isn't quite what I expected, no problem. Let us know. We'll give you a full refund of the purchase price. Now, we will drop a couple of links in the show notes to those two courses that I've just mentioned there. And as an added bonus, as a podcast listener, you can use the coupon code podcast75. That is going to get you $75 off the purchase of your very first HPA course. All right, with our introduction out of the way, let's get into our interview now. All right, welcome to the podcast, Reid. Thanks for joining us today. And I can't help but start off mentioning that I feel that everything's kind of come back around full circle now. About 5 or 6 years ago, the roles were reversed and it was you interviewing Ben and myself for the Do It For A Living podcast. So it's been an interesting ride over that time for both yourself and us. We'll talk a little bit nearer to the end of the podcast, maybe about Do It For A Living and what that is for those who haven't heard. But for a start, your Kaizen speed in the US, can you give us a sort of a 30,000 foot view of what Kaizen speed is to get started?
Yep. So we're a tuning shop. We also design and manufacture products. So the business is split about 50-50 between service, that's mostly regional, and performance products that we design in-house and then have manufactured. So, dyno tuning shop.
Okay. Unusual for most dyno tuning shops to get into parts manufacture. Obviously, we've got the Kaizen Relay, which is something we want to spend a bit of time talking about. We'll get into that in a bit. In terms of size, how big's your shop? How many staff have you got?
Yeah, so about 6 guys total. Shop's 5,000 square feet. Pretty small. Small operation, been in business for 15 years, not satisfied with where we are, continuously trying to improve on everything from service to parts to et cetera.
Sure. I think there's a hint in that name there, Kaizen, correct?
Yeah. Kaizen is the Japanese philosophy of continuous improvement. So, that means you can always get better no matter what you've achieved. But it also means you can be satisfied with incremental improvements, So it's just always trying to improve.
I mean, I think that's something that a lot of us in the automotive industry could maybe take on board, that, you get to a certain point and it's very easy to rest on your laurels and sort of, we've got this, that's good enough. But, these incremental improvements, sure, you're not going to get a massive improvement once you're sort of at a certain level, but there are always areas that you can sort of chip away at and improve. And I think as competition comes up as well, that's really important for you to focus on that and make sure that you are staying ahead of the others out there. Let's just jump back a little bit, because no one just wakes up one morning and says, hey, you know what, I'm going to start a 5,000 square foot shop with 6 guys. So how did you get into the automotive industry to start with? What was your sort of formal education, if any, and how did you get started playing with cars?
Yeah, I don't know. There's no one in my family that's into cars. When I was in middle school, I was building RC cars, like little electric stuff. And then spent my whole, middle school, high school time skateboarding. And then this was around the 2000s, like late 90s, early 2000s. And the import thing was just huge. And so, you get your driver's license and then you start looking around like, well, what's this whole car thing all about? And the import movement at that time was huge. It was a way to, I don't know, dethrone these big V8 things that, and something about that appealed to me because it was, I don't know, it seemed like counterculture. So it seemed like it went along with skateboarding to me. And I was just fascinated by it. So I pretty much stopped skateboarding at that point and just became fully obsessed with it. I don't know why, it just appealed to me.
So you mentioned there's no one in your family that was really into cars. So did this also get driven by maybe your friends at the time, those you were hanging out with?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I just looked at it and I, you know, there's a street racing going on and that seemed also appealing, probably because you're not supposed to do it.
Sure.
So yeah, just, it just snowballed into something. I think you start something and some things like, kind of fits me, kind of doesn't, but that one just, it was never ending, never, ever ending. Like you can't just go, okay, cool, I'm going to learn about this thing. Then you're good at it. Like it's just the well is deep.
Definitely. I mean, that personally is why 20 plus years into what I do, I'm still passionate about it, because you are never done learning. There's always new cars coming out. There's always new technology and you can always improve what you're doing. So I think it's one of those, it's a career that's never really finished, which appeals to me. It's maybe not for everyone, but yeah, it's not something you can say, yep, I've done that. What's next?
I just don't want to click a clock.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep, I agree.
I don't care how much money you make. I want to try and figure out a way where there's overlap between something that I love and where I can make money at it. So like where those two things overlap is where I want to spend my time.
I mean, there's the old saying, do something that you love for a job and you'll never work a day in your life. I would argue that maybe it doesn't quite pan out exactly like that, but definitely there's some truth to it.
Agreed. But a lot of your time is just spent head down digging ditches.
Yes. And I want to talk about that a little bit further on as well, what the reality of automotive business running ownership is versus maybe what some people at this stage considering going down that path think it may be, because that's really important, having a clear understanding of actually what you're getting yourself in for. But I mean, the end of the day, you're going to spend, you know, the largest portion of your life doing a job. So hey, you might as well make sure it's something that you're actually enjoying, and that's going to make your life a whole lot easier. Now, in terms of the cars that were coming out at the time, I'm going to take a wild stab in the dark. And are we maybe talking Honda here, or
that's what we're talking about? Yeah,
it seems to
be talking about Honda.
Seems to be a sort of a repeater theme that I'm getting from a lot of our podcast guests. So
U.S. guests,
definitely,
right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not knocking it either. I can't argue. It's a very strong base to build from. So let's talk about your sort of learning curve with Honda. I mean, coming from a non-automotive background, probably not a lot of what you learned on the skateboard translates too well to a Honda. So you know, when did you actually start making modifications and learning about how to work on these cars?
Yeah, so went to an auto auction with my uncle or cousin who was a dealer and was looking for a specific Honda Civic. After three auto auctions, we couldn't find the one that I wanted. So then I just bought a Prelude.
Okay.
Just because it was there and wanted to get it done. And so then I had a Prelude and it had a base model engine in it and a couple of internet searches. At that time, wasn't Google. That's how old I am. And you know, found out there's this engine called the H22, spent a lot of my time. So then I worked that whole summer as a telemarketer, actually, cold calling people and selling them voicemail services. But there was unlimited overtime. So while my friends were out between junior and senior year in high school, my friends were out, I don't know, existing. I was working 13-hour days because it was unlimited overtime and I was just trying to save up for this engine. And I still remember that engine cost $2,480 shipped. For some reason, that number sticks in my mind because that was a big part of, you know, that's all I thought about.
That's probably a fair chunk of cash back in those days as well.
Yeah. I mean, and especially I'm, you know, 16, just turning 17. So that was a shitload, more money than I've ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely. And so obviously you get this engine, you've got to figure out, how to get it in the car and how to make it work?
Yeah, so figure out how to get it in the car and just spend a lot of times on their forums, of course. I still miss forums. I think we all do. Anyone who participated in forums misses that treasure trove.
Yeah, I think the move to Facebook groups, there's pros and cons. Yeah, definitely. The amount of time I spent on build threads, both reading and researching, as well as writing our own for the cars we were building up, and those sort of became an archived kind of piece of history. Yeah. It is a bit of a shame. Yeah.
But I mean, that was a reference point that would always be there. And like, I don't know, just the way that Facebook groups are better than just regular posts for sure. So, but yeah, I'm a little nostalgic about forums, but I spent a lot of time on forums just trying to figure it out. And again, something about that was just appealing because I like to try to solve those problems. I don't know, some problems don't appeal, but man, that one just did. So there was infinite possibilities. You can do all these different modifications to these engines, and you know, it was great.
So I take it your learning curve on the Honda brand and automotive in general must have been pretty steep. Did you actually get involved in some sanctioned race events with the cars that you were driving, or was this all kind of, shall we say, street racing?
Yeah, so street racing and just local tracks. We're in the Northwest, so upper left-hand side of the United States, and there really wasn't anything going on over here. So the closest thing was California, and I didn't have a trailer or anything, so that was not anything that I ever participated in. But we did always just try to figure out how to make the car faster, and like I said, the well's deep. So the performance thing started out with minor modifications, and then as years progressed, it just turned into more and more.
Sure.
But tuning was definitely, that was black magic for sure.
Now, you did get involved in tuning and build a business around it. So we'll talk about the tuning side, but how did you sort of transition from an H22 swap and a Prelude to starting Kaizen Speed? Because obviously there's a bit of a disconnect there.
Sure. So one of the things that the H22 has, because it's a rather large inline four-cylinder engine, they have inherent engine vibration that just becomes more pronounced as the displacement increases. So they have balance shafts that spin twice the speed of the crank at the opposite direction. And so one of the big things that was discussed on the forums but never solved was how to eliminate the balance shafts. So there was a discussion whether you just remove the belt and leave them in there, or if you do pull them out, what do you do with the open oil passages? So you'd, you know, drive the bearings out, grind the tabs off, and put the bearings back in with the oil holes not lined up. So to block the now open oil passages. So I created a product where you would plug the holes where the balance shaft stuck out of the oil pump. And instead of having to drive the bearings out with a special tool that none of us had, I mean, we barely had, you know, a set of sockets. Honda enthusiasts at that time, right? So we had solid dowel pins that replaced some hollow dowel pins, and that was the new way to block the oil passages. So no one knew if it was going to work, so the best way to do it was to do it in my own engine. So we did it, and it worked, and that was our first product.
Okay. So that was a step towards Kaizen Speed.
Yeah. I've always been, as I look back, like entrepreneurialistic, I guess. When I was 12 and skateboarding, I had a skateboard wax brand, and I used to grind up graphite and put it in the wax because I somehow Googled or whatever search engine found that graphite was a lubricant. So what's graphite? Graphite's pencil lead. Literally ground up pencil lead, stuck it in my skate wax, and I had a skateboard brand, you know, of skate wax. So the point is just always, that was always just in my DNA, I suppose.
Yeah, sure. I think that is quite a unique aspect of you personally, and obviously has come through with the Kaizen Relay, which we're going to delve into. But I mean, I would say that the majority of automotive workshops making their own range of products is probably seen as too difficult. So it is really rewarding when you can see a gap in the market, something that is needed, produce something that does a really good job of filling that void, and then even more rewarding when it actually sells and you can make a little bit of money off the back of it.
Right. It's nice when you're right about it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you think you see a hole.
We, in a similar vein, back when I was running my old shop and we had a customer who wanted to go drag racing in an Evo 9, and he said to us pretty arrogantly, I guess at the time, but it turned out to be spot on, that he wanted to take down the world record. And at the time, that was held by AMS Performance in the US with a, I think it was an 8420. And we sort of, we hadn't had much experience on that late model Evo 9 chassis. So we didn't really know exactly what was involved, but we sort of got into it. Anyway, try and make a long story short here. It turned out that as soon as we got to the drag strip, he was maybe a little bit less than competent on the gear shift. And that turned out to be a really good, really big problem. When you got a car that's producing 1,000 horsepower, running to 10,500 RPM, hanging it up on the limiter for 5-10 seconds doesn't end that well. And we fixed that problem with a product that we created. We called it the Ghost Shifter. It was very niche. It was for a late model Evo 4-9 chassis. You had to have the PPG 4-speed drag dog engagement gear set. And that was basically it. Oh, you also needed a aftermarket sequential shifter mechanism. Anyway, we made a basically an alloy frame for that. It had a little air ram and a little air bottle, and it worked really well. And we sort of, we got asked to sell it to a couple of guys, and we thought, oh, we'll put it on our website. And I can't remember the numbers for such a niche product. I think we sold something like 25 or 30 of them. It was absolutely bizarre. We didn't make any money off it, but it was quite an experience to go down.
Satisfying.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, still to this day, I occasionally get asked about that product and see them pop up in various Evo drag cars. So yeah, it's kind of a bit of a blast from the past. Getting back to your story, though, so we're not here to talk about me. Getting back to your story, Honda's obviously not been the only thing that you now cover, and you deal with a wide range of domestic product, GM, Ford, etc. So you're sort of kind of dealing with both sides of that fence. Was that sort of a case of you were getting too many requests for these domestic models, or was the import side of things maybe just proven to not be sufficient to put food on the table?
That was entirely a business decision. In fact, we were actively looking for different platforms, played with the BMW N54 platform for about a year and a half, got out of that because I just didn't see it. It honestly seemed like another race to zero platform where people were just constantly bragging about how little they spent on anything. So anyways, got out of that. And then the GM thing regionally where we are is popular, and also, which is pretty common in tuning, that most people aren't doing it very well. So that one just took off like wildfire and has supplemented the product design side of things, which has longer timelines and bigger swings than service.
Sure.
Nice thing about service is you come in, we work on your car today, with the exception of a large build. But dyno tuning, for example, is done today, paid today. So that's a consistent revenue generator that allows the product side to exist.
It's interesting you mentioned that race to zero, because that's something that I also saw through my old shop. I mean, we started and had a reputation for Japanese domestic market vehicles, mainly Mitsubishi, Subaru, a fair bit of Honda in there as well. And I mean, it's awkward. I don't want to pigeonhole the owners of these cars, because obviously there's a wide range. But mm-hmm. You know, there was definitely a large subset of car owners that were coming in, and I like to say they had champagne dreams and beer budgets. So you'd sort of sit down and, you know, list out what they wanted to do, and you're sort of thinking to yourself as you go, right, well, we're probably talking $20,000-$30,000 here, and you're like, okay, so what's your budget? So two grand. Okay, well,
yeah,
you can do one of those things, one of those list of 25 things that you just put. And that was always a frustration. I mean, obviously, as a shop that specializes in tuning and building cars, we wanted to be able to do things at a high level and provide a really good quality product. And I often found that we were sacrificing the quality of the builds in order to meet the customer's budget. And the problem with that, you have to learn.
Or you sacrifice your own time.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you'd put 20 hours into a car and ended up charging 10 to the customer, which is not smart business. I think, and this is still the same, I think a lot of people really just fully underestimate the cost of doing these custom one-off jobs. And that's the other issue, was a lot of the work we were doing was not repetitive. It would be different every car that came through the doors.
This is exactly how I would have said it.
And it makes it very difficult to accurately quote. And then the biggest feedback we always hear in the industry is, you know, customer takes a car into a shop, gets an estimate for X, comes to pick up the car, and the bill is 10X. And that then reflects really badly on the shop. And that's what we wanted to try and avoid. Anyway, sort of what I found is we transitioned into the GM market, which is also reasonably active here in New Zealand, although our vehicles come out of Australia. And what we found with those was it was refreshing. We were dealing with generally a slightly older clientele. They probably had a little bit more money in their pocket and they were a bit more realistic about what things cost. But the real benefit that I saw was we could create packages for these vehicles, and we knew within a kilowatt or 2 kilowatts what the thing would produce when we were finished with it on the dyno. We could give an accurate quote that was always correct, and the customers just loved it. So that was a real turning point for my business, and it sounds like you went down a similar path.
We had to do exactly that same thing. Everything that came in was clean sheet design. You know, nobody had any idea what they were getting themselves into. So every build was, you know, new and unique, and this, what worked last year has evolved both in our knowledge and available products. So every build was exactly like you said. So we had to templatize it, and that's why we completely stopped with fabrication. We stopped, and this sounds unromantic because online and everything, oh, I want to build custom race car, da da da, and everyone's just got a rock hard one for that, and that's just you know, the way that I've found, if you're so passionate about building race cars, the only way is to sell either your own branded products or what I call OPP, other people's products, and you use your customers or the vehicles that you build as trickle down. So, right, those are your flagship vehicles. Those are the things that attract your attention and give you credibility. And but you just don't make any money there. And people that don't know say, how could you not make any money? That was $50,000. Like, yeah, but that was $100,000 worth of work. So I'm actually net 50 grand negative.
I think the other aspect with the industry, and this is starting to sound a bit negative, it's definitely not. And we'll talk a bit more
100%.
About this in a bit more detail. But there is sort of a situation with a lot of shops where a customer comes in, gets a quote for taking their car from 200 to 400 horsepower, for an example. So, you know, you'll give them a quote with the parts that they're going to require. And then, of course, they go onto eBay or to their mate who's importing parts out of China or Japan and brings you then all of the parts that you've quoted. They're probably paid, you know, a little bit less, probably not a heap less, but a little bit less. And then you're left to basically fit all of these parts and you're not making any margin on them, which, you know, most automotive shop owners that I know of, and certainly it was the case for me, we don't have $1 million sitting in the bank. It doesn't work like this. It is not a job where you're going to be making huge amounts of money. So the margins are slim, and we rely on those parts margins to actually put food on the table, essentially pay our staff, etc. And then there's a handful of shops who I see, and I don't quite know how they've gone about it, but they've progressed to a point where if a customer comes to them, basically if they bring their own parts, it's no deal. You buy the parts from the shop and they'll fit them or go somewhere else. But there's only a handful of shops that kind of can get to that point.
Yep, for sure. We we're always scared to do that, and we just recently implemented that with very few exceptions. And it's not a cash grab. It has nothing to do with money. What it has to do with is trying to sort out and offer not warranty, but good results with parts that are unknown, or fitment between three, four, five, six different brands of parts.
Absolutely.
So we have to stick with what we know fits, or else, you know, if a runner from a header is touching the starter, and I have to spend more time massaging that, or, you know, otherwise fixing the problem, customer doesn't want to pay for that or doesn't understand. I don't know. It's just the only way to do it is to do it with parts that are known.
Definitely.
And you have to have also the balls to cut a customer loose. However, in the come up, which can last 5+ years, you're going to eat a shit sandwich. What do you guys say? The hard yards, right?
Yeah.
You got to put in the hard yards.
Hard yards, yeah, for sure. Yeah, you're 100% right. I mean, obviously there is a financial aspect to it, but I mean, I think the bigger one, which I didn't mention before, as you've just rightly pointed out, is you do want to be providing your customer with known products that you've tested and proven, because not all products are created equal, and a package of parts that you know is going to get the job done. The other aspect, when customers are bringing parts from 5 different sources and you're left with putting them all together and trying to make them work, you know, it gets to be a shit show when something goes wrong, because it becomes a finger pointing exercise. So I actually see for the usually small increase in overall cost, the peace of mind for the customer and knowing that you've got a one stop shop. If anything is wrong, if something fails, you know exactly who to talk to, and there's going to be no argument. So
right.
I think, yeah, just things that maybe those listening to this podcast, particularly if they're looking at getting a build done, these are the things that are really easy to overlook but make a big difference to the finished product. You're probably going to keep you on side with the workshop that you choose as well. Right, let's move on a little bit. So we've talked about the addition of the GM vehicles to what you were supporting. And I'm interested in sort of understanding what the learning curve for you as a workshop was when you bring in a new model. Obviously, when you're dealing with something you've never dealt with before, how do you go about learning the ins and outs of that vehicle? Were you doing this sort of slowly but surely with the customer vehicles? Did you end up doing a shop build or, yeah?
Yeah, both. So it was a pretty big transition. So going from speed density standalone Honda stuff to mass airflow, OEM ECU, GM stuff was quite a transition. So we dipped our toes. This was probably back in 2014, 13 or 14. Dipped our toes, played with it with minor builds. I bought a C6, Z06, and just started learning with my own car. And that's when I became, you know, proficient or, you know, somewhat competent with the OEM ECU.
Okay.
So you have to do that, right? I mean, you have to start small and then, you know, dip your toes first. But the best way is to have your own vehicle that that you're forced to spend time with.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think trying to learn on a customer's car is fraught with potential danger. I mean, yes, absolutely, it can be done. But I mean, just the hours that you're going to put into learning a new platform, particularly with OE reflashing, we're dealing with a complex ECU that is not a two-minute job to understand all of the ins and outs and nuances of. So trying to do that on a customer car versus your own, it's definitely makes things a little bit more difficult. Even within the likes of the GM platform, for example, there's obviously learning curves that go along with that. And one of them, I mean, it's definitely not new now, but when GM went from the Gen 4 LS platform to the Gen 5 with direct injection, what was the learning curve like for that? And where were the challenges in learning that new Gen 5 platform?
So the Gen 4 to Gen 5, going from port injected to DI and all the torque-based idle control stuff was pretty significant difference for sure, especially when there's just not a lot of information. So when it's brand new, there's some people that know. The people that intimately know generally don't share because it's basically their IP, unless they're in a position such as yourself where you know, your business is providing that information. But it's tough. It was just a lot of time and a lot of trial and error. But it's the same thing that any new platform is. You just have to spend time with it. So you just have to know that when you're transitioning to a new platform, you're going to spend significantly more time learning than just, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe just for those listening who aren't aware of the differences, could you maybe give us like a high-level view of what a traditional math-based ECU is or how that works versus the newer talk-based? Because we see talk-based ECUs are basically the what we see in the OE world now just about across the board.
Yeah. So Gen 4 GM stuff, which was, you know, early 2000s up till about 2015, was all mass airflow based airflow. Everything was based on airflow. And now in the Gen 5 direct injected stuff, everything is based on torque. So when you want to command the throttle open more, that is generally done with a change in torque instead of a change in airflow. So just, it was just a big transition and trying to understand what the torque tables, how they affect things, which things are affected in the background that maybe you don't find out until a little bit later. So yeah, I mean, that was just a different transition.
Okay. And I mean, the challenge there is one of the biggest drivers that the factory ECU has to control, you just mentioned, is the throttle plate, throttle body. So, you know, you can basically in a torque-based ECU add all of the go-fast parts to the engine that should, in theory, add up to, let's say, another 100 horsepower. And then you go put it on the dyno and you find out that you're nowhere near that. And in fact, maybe sometimes worse than stock. But when you actually dig into the data logging, what's happening is that factory ECU is actually just closing the throttle. So you could be mashing the throttle pedal through the firewall, but because it's a drive-by-wire throttle, the ECU is like, nah, I've got this. Don't worry about that. I'll just close that down for you, and you don't have what you think.
Exactly. I remember actually the first one we did was almost, I think the only modification was an intake on a, you know, a new C7 Corvette. And so like literally about as stock as it could possibly get. And there was just these throttle closure, you know, 20-30% throttle closure in the mid range. And you're going, wait, why is that? What is that all about? And that was really my first experience with torque based stuff. Yeah. And that was, it's definitely a change from anything that I had done in the past.
I'm also interested in your opinion just in general of port injection versus direct. Obviously, again, the way we're seeing pretty much everything modern go is to direct injection. From a performance standpoint, can you give us your idea of the pros and cons between the two?
So I really like that DI is good with cold start. Seems to be a lot better than port injected aftermarket vehicles are. I prefer both. So I'd like to have, in a perfect world, I think you have two fuel systems. So you've got the DI with your startup, your cruise, your drivability, et cetera. And then you've got staged injection. And this is really has more to do with staged injection than it does with DI and PI. But, you know, having some large injector that couldn't be bothered with doing startup and cruise very well. So you can have this large injector. So kind of the best of both worlds. But I have been impressed with even high ethanol content DI cars are significantly better at cold start than PI cars are.
Yeah, I think that's definitely accurate. We're lucky enough that one of our development cars is a Toyota 86, which from stock has both direct injection and port injection. So yeah, I'm a big fan of that. One of the nice features with having port injection on a direct injected engine is because you've still got fuel flowing through the intake ports, it gets away from the carbon buildup on the back of the intake valves, which is so common with direct injected engines.
with driven, you know, street driven vehicles.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously not an issue with race engines so much, but high mileage, yeah. I mean, the other thing for those who might be wondering, well, why do we need port injection? It's a situation, and it's very dependent on the model of engine you're talking about, but we don't have the access to such a wide range of different size direct injectors out there on the market like we do with port injectors. So for certain models, sometimes the support is better than others, but for certain models, particularly if you're going to go to an ethanol fuel and you need to supply, let's say, 35-40% more fuel volume to make the same power compared to what you were on pump gas, that can straight away put you at essentially the flow capability limits of the factory DI injectors. So if you haven't got the option of larger ones from a different model or something in the aftermarket, then adding port injection is a nice solution to get around that, I think.
Yep. And the DI well is deep as well, because there's other supporting things like the fuel pump, and it's not even... So for example, to make the fuel pump flow more, you don't change the fuel pump, you change the cam. Right. So it's a departure from, you know, previous methods.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. There's definitely a big learning curve involved with direct injection. When you are dealing with a vehicle that's maybe new to you or relatively new to the market, and you're sort of a early mover on that and starting to make significant modifications, have you got a process you go through in terms of trying to figure out where a safe power level is before you need to start upgrading components inside the engine?
Gosh, that's a great question. I wish I did. You just go until the rods come out.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe that's not true either. I was going to say you'll break a piston before you bend a rod or break a rod, but that's not always the case. I don't. You just start reasonably small and just kind of let it grow with time. And of course, you're trying to align with people that are doing the same thing. And so you have your network and you try and share experiences. So that's where it's really good to not be the bridge burner, but to be a, participator in the community, not just in a taking way, but in trying to provide, your experience as well. So yeah, I mean, you just, ask your friend. do what you can do and ask your friend the rest, and he'll do the same. And then together as a group, if you've got a good group, you'll sort it out over, and you just try and shorten that period of time that takes, you know.
Sure.
That I don't know about a process.
No, I mean, it's obviously not something that's always going to be the same. I think we always get asked, or there's an assumption, I think I should say, more to the point, that in order to learn how to tune, which is a slightly different angle to this question, but in order to learn how to tune, you've got to blow up 10, 15, 20 engines, which I totally disagree with.
I disagree 100% with that as well.
I mean, sure. It was literally years after I started learning how to tune that I actually first suffered an engine failure. And that was nothing to do with the tune itself. So it's definitely possible if you know what you're doing. Now, that gets into a different aspect when we're actually talking about engine mechanical strength, because you could have your air fuel ratio dialed in on point, nice, safe ignition timing with no hint of knock occurring. And I mean, if the cylinder pressure is just exceeding the mechanical strength of a component, be it a piston or a conrod, well, game over, you've got an air-conditioned block, and no one wants that. I mean, I think where I see the bigger issue with that is when you are dealing with a brand new engine that has just been released and you are a first mover on that platform, you've got no trail to follow of those who have been, been ahead of you. There's probably not often that we will be in that situation unless you really want to be on the cutting edge. And more often, at least what I was dealing with, we're coming into a model year 2 or 3 years after release. And I always found it obviously needs to be dealt with carefully, take it with a grain of salt, but you know, you spend enough time on some forums, and again we come back to the nostalgia of forums, you could see the build recipes that had gone before, and you start to build up a bit of an understanding of, okay, well, these are the weak points for this particular engine, and within reason at this sort of power level, it seems that conrods are the weak point, or the piston, or whatever. So I think that sort of research generally keeps you safe. The other thing I will say, though, is a lot of this does come down to whether an engine's going to fail or lead a long and healthy life, does come down a lot to the intelligence of the tuner. And I've seen engines fail from poor quality tunes, you know, 100 kilowatts at the wheels below what we could reliably make for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years of racing. So there's levels to this stuff as well that need to be understood.
And not always it. So a tune is more than just how it acts on the dyno, but taking into consideration the different environmental impacts when the vehicle leaves the dyno, and making sure that it's going to be providing the appropriate amount of timing and fuel for those conditions. So you know how it is on the dyno. But I mean that's pretty basic, right? Like you know, ignition timing by intake air temperature, for example. I mean, you'd have to be kind of a nimwit to only modify the ignition tables and not, you know, interpolate out, you know, for different conditions.
Definitely. I think probably the bigger thing I see is maybe a lack of understanding of what's actually happening in terms of cylinder pressure inside the engine. And I'll give an example. At one point, I was involved with a Mitsubishi Evo 9 drag car, and it was the customer at the time wanted to run with the stock block record. So, as its name implies, we're dealing with a stock engine. Those engines are actually phenomenally well built and really strong for a factory engine. But you know, if you want to make 600, 700 wheel horsepower from an engine that was designed for 300 at the flywheel, that's a challenge. So, you know, where I'm going with this is, you can get away with this to a degree if you understand that, well, the peak cylinder pressure is what the conrod has to put up with. So, well, what we're going to do here is let's keep the boost relatively low and the ignition timing nice and conservative through that peak torque area where our cylinder pressure is really high. And then once the torque starts to drop away, well, what we can do is then feed some more boost in and keep that torque relatively flat right the way out to the red line. And I think it's the subtle things like that. I mean, you know, that's not rocket science, but these are the things that are easy to overlook and why some tuners can hold engines together while others consistently have them fall to pieces.
Sure, 100%.
Moving on to the tuning solutions, and we've sort of touched on a little bit of this already. I mean, in the early days when you were getting started with the Honda platform, Honda is actually a great solution, which was around back then. But the other solution, which was popular for the likes of those earlier vehicles, which was simpler, was an aftermarket standalone ECU. Basically, we rip out the stock ECU, wire in or plug in a standalone, instant full control over everything in real time. These days, particularly with the late model GM, Ford, well, just about anything really current, it's much more difficult to do that with the complexity of the communication between the different modules in the vehicle. So it's difficult but not impossible. So we are much more likely now to be reflashing, or in other words, retuning the factory ECU. Can you give us your sort of ideas on pros and cons of reflash versus standalone?
Sure. I think that reflashing is probably good for 90% of what you can accomplish. And then as you start to get into really big horsepower stuff where you have really large injectors or multiple fuel pumps, you know, in enormous intakes, things like that, then it just makes sense to go to a standalone. Then the downside at that point is it's just a dollar amount, because in my opinion, a Motec can do everything that the factory ECU can do, including run all the factory transmission control module, gauge cluster, you know, HVAC, everything. The only downside, if you really look at it, is just cost, but it's a significant cost. So I think a lot of times people think they want more power than they really do.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think the internet, unfortunately, has a lot to answer for with that. And I mean, even back, you know, the later days of my shop, you know, we'd have customers come in and say, look, I want 1,000 horsepower. And you knew that they'd probably never driven a car that had a genuine 400 horsepower. And trying to educate on, you know, on the street in particular, a well-built 500 horsepower version of what that person was driving would be more fun and much faster than the 1,000 horsepower version. But I think, you know, the problem has come with bragging rights and dyno sheets on internet forums and Facebook, and now everyone thinks that they need 1,000 horsepower to have fun, and it's simply not the case.
Yeah, I mean, it's becoming more the case because 1,000 horsepower is becoming easier and easier, and the aftermarket's catching up with clutches that are, you know, less terrible to drive. You know, they actually have maybe a little bit of engagement, etc. But, you know, I do agree that in the significant number of situations, what a customer that comes to you and says, I want 1,000 horsepower car, really is telling you, I want a fast car that I like to get in and go and drive. You know, unless they are just trying to flex for the gram or whatever.
I think I probably do need to actually add a couple of caveats to what I've just said, because my reference there is I'm sort of thinking my bread and butter back in the day, which would be the likes of an Evo or a Subaru STI. And, you know, we recently had John from Shep Trans on the podcast, and he's talking about his R8, which puts out, if memory serves correct, 1,700 wheel horsepower, runs a high 7 on the quarter, and literally drives like a stock R8 on the street. So, you know, there's levels to this stuff, and what we can get away with, you know, on these modern vehicles with dual clutch transmissions and a bit more capacity, yes, we probably can have more power, and 1,000 probably isn't actually that ridiculous, but, you know.
But it's just a money thing, as that really is. Money is a differentiator between the levels.
Yes, of course. Now, coming back to the reflashing, you've mentioned Motec there, and Motec, I think, is probably in a unique situation because on their M1 platform, they offer a development package. So we've got some really smart people out there who are reverse engineering all the factory CAN bus so that they're able to replicate those messages and run an M1 ECU, but still keep the automatic transmission or DCT, TCM, happy, gauge cluster, HVAC, everything you've just mentioned. That's the exception, though, not the norm. And as you mentioned, you're going to usually pay a handsome fee to basically cover the hundreds of hours the developer has put into all of that background work. So, you know, if we're not considering like an all-out race car here, and you're mm-hmm. taking an application which maybe runs on HP tuners for reflashing, or the Motec M1 platform as a standalone with a substantial price differential between the two, what are we getting on the M1 platform that the factory ECU properly reflashed on HP tuners can't provide?
Closed loop wideband control in all conditions is one. You know, tunable traction control in differing levels, you know, on the fly. So, you know, you've got your traction control switch, of course, but it's just not the same as the multitudes of different ways you can set up traction control, you know, driven versus undriven wheel speed differential. So what can Motec do? It can save you a little bit better than HP tuners. And that's not a deficiency in HP tuners. It's just, HP tuners can only do so much with the existing hardware and software that's provided from the manufacturer. So when you switch to a standalone, I think you get wideband fuel control, I think, is huge. Tunable traction control, I think, is huge. Integrated boost control, differing types of boost control strategies, map switching on the fly. You know, those are the types of things that you can do with external components with HP tuners or with a reflash. You know, you've got now a smorgasbord of, you know, an external boost controller. You've got maybe an external traction control device that's, you know, modifying signals to the ECU. So, but again, you know, you don't need traction control if you've got a big enough tire or if you only race on prepped surfaces. So for 90% of people, I think the stock ECU does well. And there are a lot of people that try to, you know, stock ECU record. And you know, that's just another one. I mean, everybody tries to break every kind of record. You know, you've got the stock ECU record, the pump gas record, the whatever.
Yeah, I mean, obviously bragging rights are important. It seems like as time goes by, we're getting more and more ridiculous records for the fastest red GTR with a white gear lever on it or something of that nature. I don't know. It's getting a little out of hand, but I mean, I know people do like to claim records. I think I'll add one more element that you didn't touch on, which I think is really important with that transition between reflashing and standalone, is data logging. It's tricky, and we don't have the quality of data logging through a reflash platform that we can in the aftermarket. And I mean, the reality is what we've sort of just talked about there. There's no black and white line where you want to go here, you must go standalone. You want to go here, you must go reflash. It's more shades of gray in that area.
Yeah, series of trade-offs.
Yeah, and understanding those trade-offs. And I mean, I think in essence, in most cases now, with the popular platforms, there's not a lot that we couldn't do with reflashing. Would it be the right option? Maybe not always. And the other thing that I think is really easy to overlook is as the engine combination becomes further and further removed from stock, the relevance of that factory ECU starts to become questionable. So, you know, by the time we change the engine capacity, the compression ratio, port the heads, different cam profile that's dramatically different to stock, you know, where we get into a situation with reflashing, because in a lot of cases we can't tune live, it becomes incredibly time consuming, particularly with some vehicles. You know, the flash time, I'm dealing with a little Volkswagen Golf at the moment that we're doing some development work on, and the flash time's 9 minutes. So yeah, you start to think twice about making a 5-degree change to the cam timing at 4,500 RPM, because yeah, you know, that's a substantial time you're wasting on the dyno just sitting there scrolling Instagram while the flash continues.
Yeah, for sure. I used to hate tuning GM stuff, and that was when the flash time was only 30 seconds, but it blew my mind that I was working on a newer vehicle, like 15 years newer than what I was working on before, and now all of a sudden I couldn't change things live. That was probably the biggest hurdle that I had moving into OEM ECU reflash stuff. And now you're used to it because you're better at that tuning process. But yeah, for sure, being able to tune live is that's a huge one. Or it was a huge one. There's definitely, you know, if that's all you've ever known, then you don't even know the difference. But
I think that the other thing that's important to understand is, you know, yes, there's these big builds with just about every component I just mentioned has been changed from factory. But that's the exception, not the norm. And the bread and butter work for most tuning shops is, you know, headers, an exhaust, and an intake. And with those, you know, generally, because unlike a standalone, we're actually starting from a really well-developed factory calibration. We only generally need to focus on maybe rescaling the MAF, but then it's basically wide open throttle, fuel, and ignition. And I mean, at least often I found with our stage one and stage two upgrades, it would take just about as long to get the car on and off the dyno as it did to actually do the calibration. Plus, we'd done so many of them, you know, you had a library of starting points. So you knew we're going to be there or thereabouts to get us up and running, and then it was just fine tuning.
That's how you know you're doing your tuning shop right, when you've templatized it enough that you're not starting from scratch every
time. Yeah, I mean, I think it's just like the builds. You're getting away from those one-offs every time. And that's where the ability to sort of multiply your returns for a tuning shop becomes so valuable. Look, we'll move on anyway, Reid. And I just wanted to quickly touch on dynos. Obviously, key tool for any dyno tuning shop. I know at the moment you're running the same dyno we are, which is the Mainline Pro Hub. You've come from a rolling road background as well. Now, just we always get asked this question about the pros and cons of rolling road versus hub dyno. So give us your take on the situation.
Having had the hub dyno now, that's no comparison. The only hiccup or hesitation I had over the years was how much of a pain it was going to be to jack up every vehicle, remove the wheels, et cetera. I think it takes a little bit less time actually. And especially as knurling on the rollers would wear out and we were, you know, towards the end, we were constantly fighting traction issues, sometimes on 450 horsepower cars. So we became, we had a joke in the shop that we would tune, we would do strap tuning as much as we would do engine tuning. So tuning how we were, you know, we would actually let it crawl up onto the front roller a little bit. So we would tune it just the right amount of traction over the lower control arms in the rear, and then retaining straps backwards so it could actually crawl up onto the front roller like it's a dyno jet, like on some old big roller dyno, and it would have more traction when it was on top of the front roller instead of kind of in between the bed of rollers. So long story short, it became such a pain. And you know, with these vehicles now that make, you know, there's like the C7 Corvette Z06 from the factory makes, you know, 650 wheel torque, or you know, 600 wheel torque, etc. So you know, and it's on a PD blower, so it's immediate. So we were having these issues where, you know, we'd lose traction even on a stock vehicle before we've even done anything. So I really love the hub dyno; it's fantastic. The only downside is that you have to have, if you do a plethora of vehicles, you got to have all these different hub adapters. However, you know, the 3-4 hub adapters that we have fit 90% of vehicles. And this all also goes back to, you know, if you're trying to be everything to everyone, you're going to fail.
Yeah.
So, you know, as long as you're specializing, then that's not even an issue either. So I absolutely love the hub dyno. It's amazing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think the usual argument I hear is that it takes so much longer to put the car onto the hub dyno, which you've just mentioned isn't really the case. I was kind of fortunate in that I started with my tuning business. We had a Dynapack hub dyno, which is a really great device. It's hydraulic based. I'd say the downside of the Dynapack dyno, which they really still haven't addressed, is, you know, in this modern era, it just can't handle the power that we produce. So that was a downside. When we started High Performance Academy, I moved to a mainline rolling road, started two-wheel drive, went four-wheel drive. And exactly what you're mentioning there, you're spending as much time on these more powerful cars, strapping the car properly to allow it to work. And honestly, on a two-wheel drive car, it'd probably be 15 minutes, you know, to get a car onto a hub dyno. It's not that big of a challenge. And the other thing I found as well with more modern cars is, you know, when they've got flat floors or diffusers, getting access to good strapping points is a real pain in the ass. And no one really wants to be taking the rear diffuser off a car just so you can get access to some lower control arms or whatever you need.
Yeah.
The other thing I'll mention as well, this sticks in my mind. We were doing this for a worked example for one of our courses, and we had a supercharged LSA vehicle, and I'd run it up, and I was actually partway through the tuning, and the rear tires on the car were absolutely rinsed to the point where I actually noticed that we're starting to get a little bit of the metal sort of strands coming through, which obviously is not ideal. I didn't really want to have a tire blow out on the dyno on a customer's car. So I said to the customer, hey, look, this is the situation. And he dropped off 2 new tires. We got those fitted up. And straight away, with the new tires, which were a different brand and nice and sticky versus what was essentially almost a slick, there was something like about a 30 horsepower deficit. We actually lost 30 horsepower. And you know, you see that and you're like, well, shit, that's a bit tough to explain to the customer. You know, I was at 550 horsepower and we've actually made some more modifications and now you're at 540. You know, that's the reality. I know what it was, but trying to explain that to a customer and, you know, in good faith, that's challenging. So you know, I like the hub dyno, the repeatability. Every time it just is what it is, and that's nice. Plus, obviously, the safety aspect of you know that thing is not jumping off the dyno.
I'll touch one more thing with the hub dyno. So what's a big part with GM tuning is tuning the transmission. So you know, maybe that sounds funny. What do you mean tuning the transition or the transmission? But this goes back to applied torque and getting gear shifts to happen at a certain RPM, and then also to apply the appropriate amount of line pressure so that that gear change doesn't slip or otherwise act funny. So having the hub dyno allows us to do that in the shop because we can accelerate from first gear instead of having to go tune the engine on the dyno and then go drive a 1,000 horsepower thing with questionable tires on the street.
Yeah.
Which we did for years, and every time I cursed it because, and people say, oh man, that must be so much fun. You get to drive all these customer vehicles. No, it's absolutely terrible.
Yeah, I agree.
Because you have to drive this vehicle at your liability on a public road and risk both damaging the vehicle or being stranded if something silly happens, like losing a belt or something, or wrecking. Anyways,
yeah.
Love to be able to tune the transmission on the dyno. It's fantastic.
Yeah, definitely. All right, let's move on, and I want to dive into, this is really probably one of the main points of this convo, is the Kaizen Relay. And we got acquainted with this back at SEMA, I think it was, maybe 2019, I want to say. Could be wrong there. And I think you won an award at SEMA for that.
Yeah, we did. So we entered a product launch competition called SEMA Launchpad. We won that with the Kaizen Relay 3D printed prototypes. And fast forward to now, we have production plastic injection molded units.
All right. So there's a lot to unpack with this process, but let's start with the basics. For those who have never heard of a Kaizen Relay, what is a Kaizen Relay?
Sure. So a Kaizen Relay is an interconnectable solid state relay that can directly interface with, you know, stranded wire without a particular connector. So what that means is you don't need tools. It's a smart IC, so it has circuit protection where it will shut itself off, which means you don't have to fuse outputs. So at its most very basic, it is a modern version improvement of your standard square cube relay that we've all used everywhere, whether that's in a fuse box or standalone with a little mounting tab. So anywhere that one of those relays can be used, a Kaizen relay can be used, okay. But it's solid state, so it can PWM. And then we have an optional control module to allow CAN access.
Okay. Again, a bunch of stuff to dive into there. For those who may be unaware of that term solid state, can you tell us, you know, in a nutshell, sure, what that means and how that actually differs from a conventional mechanical relay?
Sure. Instead of mechanical contacts actually, you know, making contact and completing a circuit, you've got an integrated circuit or a MOSFET internal to the device. And you can provide a PWM signal to control the speed of a motor or the brightness of a light.
Okay. So this is essentially the same internal technology that modern power distribution modules are using to get rid of relays and fuses entirely, correct?
That's right. So think of each Kaizen relay as one channel of a PDM, one very high ampacity channel of a PDM.
Now, you've gone a little bit further because, I mean, in itself, solid-state relays are not anything particularly new, but where you've sort of differentiated yourself and made this a really useful product is, in several terms you've mentioned, the ability to connect wires to it without needing any tools. You don't need to be crimping or doing anything of that nature. And then the ability to basically daisy chain these together. So can you talk to us, first of all, about how the interconnectability works with them?
Sure. So we applied for our patent, and actually we're just recently granted our US patent. And what that covers is the ability to interconnect relays in a standalone fashion. So the way that you would use a Kaizen relay is you would wire the first one in the same way that you would wire any relay. You've got battery power, you've got an output, you've got a ground and a trigger. That trigger can be a switch to ground or a switch to supply power. And once you power one relay, that same power and ground is available on the left and right-hand side. So with another Kaizen relay, you can just attach it and it is instantly powered. So it has battery power and ground supplied through an internal bus.
So massively sort of improving or reducing the work and workload for the person actually doing the wiring installation?
It's a forethought thing. So as much as we like to believe that we know everything that a project is going to need, undoubtedly it's going to need something else down the road as the project grows. So the idea here, so we were installing relays so often, and we would install, you know, started with 1, 2, 3, turned to 4, 5. Now, on this fender or firewall, I've got 5 relays, and it just seemed to me redundant that each one of these has to have their own supply power and ground. When why can't we apply it to one and then use it?
Yeah.
So that was, I really took off with that idea. And the whole thing here is that we're just trying to make this so anybody can have a quality product, even if they don't have PDM money. Like, simplicity is the name of the game, right? We wanted access for everyone, so anyone can install them, not just specialists, because not everyone has the skills that like you have, the tools, you know, even if they won't admit it, but everybody wants a quality build.
Definitely.
So the whole thing is every, you know, a PDM or even weatherproof old school relays, you know, you'd have to maybe comb through a data sheet to find out if it was going to handle the current that you wanted. Okay, now you got to find part number for the relay, for the connector, for the contacts, and for the crimping tool that you're going to need. And that's fine if you do this every day, you know, but I wanted to build something that was of quality, can, and really just covered 90% of the use cases. And so we started out with just a relay that was going to be interconnectable. Okay, well, if we're going to design it from scratch, it might as well be solid state. Okay, well, if we're going to design it from scratch, you know, let's make it terminate wires without tools too. Okay. All right, well, let's add some LED status indication. Okay, let's add like a little test button. And so it became this, and actually we defeatured it so it wasn't just this Swiss Army knife, because what we're really trying to do is just look, it's just a badass solid state relay in its most basic form. Yeah. But it can do a lot of PDM things too.
Let's talk a little bit more about the wiring connections, because I had a play with this at SEMA, and we did a video with you then that maybe we can link to in the show notes as well, which goes into that prototype in a bit more detail than we can here. Obviously here we don't have the benefit of images to work with, but yeah, tell us how that wiring connection works, because it's something I had never seen before. And as you'll recall, I was a little bit skeptical, but you made me a believer. So yeah, tell us how it works.
Yeah, 100%. So it's a spring cage clamp internal. So there's a lever that you lift up that compresses a spring cage clamp internal, and you just remove a 1/2 inch of insulation from your wire and insert it and snap the lever down. And that captures the wire and clamps it up against a solid copper bus bar internally. And that's how we do wire connections for the input and output. Now, the triggers are low current stuff, so they engage a smaller gauge of wire. And it's a modified spring cage where you have to depress and hold while you insert the wire. But as soon as you lift, or as soon as you stop holding, it will engage the removed, you know, insulation from your wire, and that's it. So once, you know, first we pass the wire through a weather resistant seal, so it engages the jacket of the wire. So we're trying to keep the electrical contacts from exposure to the elements. But yeah, spring cage is, it's pretty neat, I'll be honest with you. And I think we were the first one to start using it in this world. And I don't know that it's going to replace connectors. It shouldn't, because if you have all the forethought, a connector is an amazing thing. What we're trying to do is offer a quick way to terminate a wire reliably and consistently without special tools. The last thing that I'll say is, as opposed to like a screw terminal, where if you have three different guys in your shop and you ask them all to terminate a wire with a screw terminal, all three guys are going to apply a different amount of torque to that screw.
Yep.
So a spring cage clamp is a way to consistently get the same result over and over and over without a trained technician. right? So it's consistency without training.
And these are a well-proven product. You said you've brought that product to this particular unit, but you haven't invented the technology. It's out there. It's well-proven in industries already, yes.
Absolutely. You know, industrial stuff, it's everywhere. And I think maybe it's just, you know, everybody does it the same way because that's the way it's always been done, kind of a thing.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you've got can control capability. So talk us through what that is and how that works.
Sure. So we originally weren't going to do that either. We were just going to make an interconnectable relay. But then we said, as long as we've got power and ground available here, why don't we add a module that would basically make it smart? So a relay is inherently a dumb device. It has to be told what to do, whether you're flipping a switch or an ECU is flipping a switch, turning a device on or pulsing it. So the control module is, for lack of a better word, a mini ECU. So it's a controller. So our particular control module has a single CAN bus, three analog inputs, and can control three Kaizen relays. And it's entirely open source and programmable. So the idea is, we're not trying to replace a PDM, of course. And we actually had that question a lot at the trade shows over this SEMA and PRI this year. No, well, what if I want to run all this? Well, then just buy a PDM. Those are fantastic. There's nothing between a $10 relay and a $1,000 plus PDM. And so there's a lot of opportunities there. Maybe if today you don't think you know anything or need CAN control, maybe you don't even know what that is. But if you use a Kaizen relay in the place of a relay, you future-proof yourself so that if later on that becomes part of your build or you need to add something like that, then you can do that. Sure. But we're still just talking about it in its most universal application. Our job now is to create users, like very specific applications. Like one of the applications that we have now is as a pulse bar harness for the, you know, Polaris side by side, and it plugs into the diagnostic port and plugs into the factory pulse bar, which provides power and ground, and it gives us plug and play access to the CAN bus. And then we can do things like activate reverse lights as soon as you go into reverse, because gear indication is broadcast on the bus. We can do things like make your light bar get brighter as vehicle speed increases, etc. So yeah, we're trying to, like, back to templatizing, we're trying to make little snippets of applications.
Yeah, and essentially what I'm reading from this is you've got a very flexible product, and particularly now you've got that CAN bus integration, it's essentially almost the sky's the limit. So, you know, basically only limited by your imagination, correct?
Yeah, your imagination and your skill set. Yeah. So we offer custom programming. If you have the ability to do that yourself, it's entirely open source. We provide documents as well as starting programs, et cetera, that are downloadable for free from our website. We have development partners such as RaceSpec that we have worked alongside to train them how to write their own custom programs. So you would just call one of our development partners who is available from our website and say, this is what I'm trying to accomplish. And they will create that program for you. And then you own it.
Sure.
So the other aspect that is unique is that we want you to build with Kaizen relays. So it doesn't have to be a Kaizen relay. It can be your own branded product. You know, with enough quantity, we'll mold them in yellow and you can have HPA solid state relays, right?
Yeah. In terms of the journey you've been down with this product from inception of the idea through to now having a saleable product, and I'm guessing that was maybe about a 3-year process. I could be off the mark there. What have you learned? How much harder or maybe easier was it than you had envisaged? And I guess ultimately, would you do it again knowing what you know now?
I would, for sure, because I learned so much along the way, from design to iteration, manufacturing. But I would not have had, if I would have tried this a couple years earlier than I did, I would have failed because I wouldn't have had the patience and I wouldn't have understood really what it was going to take. So I started this thing understanding this was going to be a shitstorm of a project. I had unknown unforeseens. I had never done this manufacturing process, any of these manufacturing processes before. So, but I'm a stubborn fuck. So once I decide I'm going to do something, I'm just on it. And just on it, just no matter what. I mean, even, yeah. So I won't bore you too much with all these details, but it was just a significant learning curve in the same way that you don't know how to tune. So you start looking for who does know how to tune, what resources are available. And then it's just a matter of, spending the time. Yeah. So yeah, it was a significant investment of time.
One of the things that I would always be concerned about from a manufacturing standpoint is the risk of someone ripping off the design. And you've mentioned that you've just had a US patent approved. Does that patent really give you full protection? How much of a concern is a company in, you know, China, for example, making the Kaizen version of their own version of the Kaizen relay? Is that sort of play on your mind at all?
Sure. So a patent is just a shield. Really all it does is it costs you a bunch of time and money and gives you the opportunity to spend more time and money pursuing anybody that infringes upon it. So definitely, right? There are ways to get around this, but the complexity of the product, there is no shortcut to permanent mold tooling. So at the very least, no one's going to rip it off until it's proven that it sells well, and which is going to be, you know, years in the making on this standard product life cycle as we approach this bell curve. No matter what, it's going to be years in the making. So, you know, right now we've sold, you know, 1,000 pieces. As we grow and improve that over the next 2 to 3 years, then it starts to become significant numbers. And all the pirates that are out there watching it at that point, they say, okay, now it makes sense. Get started. So, you know, I've got a 4-year head start at the absolute very least.
I mean, I guess the other thing is over that time, you build up that brand recognition and people will know, like, and trust the product. So we can only hope at that point that pirate products come out that, you know, given the choice of the genuine article or something that's a knockoff, hopefully people will continue to choose your product.
I'm not really that worried about it, to be honest with you. Sure. But one other thing I want to say is people always worry about this. Oh man, you know what? Oh, don't do that. Someone's going to rip that off. What I would say is if somebody says that to you, literally, I would challenge you to try and get someone to rip off your product. So literally, if you have an idea, spend a week trying to get someone else to make it. Like, look, I have this really good idea, and approach people who would potentially be, you know, rip you off or whatever. And it's they're not as interested and excited about your idea as you think they are.
Interesting. Yeah, I wouldn't really have looked at it that way, but it makes sense. In terms of the finished product now, it is for sale. Can you give us a sense of what the retail price point is for one of these?
Yeah, so Kaizen relays are $99. And a control module is $125. A control module can control 3 relays. So for a CAN-enabled 3 output device, 40 amps per device would cost you $425.
Okay. So as you say, you're definitely not as cheap as the conventional mechanical relays, but you're spanning that nice sort of area between the conventional relay and the PDM, which, as you say, you know, maybe $1,000 give or take is probably an entry point for PDM. So yeah, that it does seem to sit nicely in the middle.
It's the only way that you could actually develop a CAN enabled product and include it with a kit. So really what we're our biggest initiative is getting even small shops to use Kaizen relays as a part of their product. So if you've got an application that, you know, say is an aux fuel pump is a really popular application that we've worked with lots of different shops on. So you can't provide an aux fuel pump with a PDM and sell your aux fuel pump kit because the PDM is more than the entire rest of the product. So if you now have a piece of hardware that you can build your product on and include with. That's what we're trying to do. So if you're going to build a product with the Kaizen Relay, we'll write the program for you for free and you own the IP. So we can't be, I can't be the guy in the Subaru world. I can't be the guy in the A90 Supra world and in the truck world. And I can't be all those people. So we want to have a piece of hardware that the person that is the man or the, you know, the go-to in every different segment, will help them build their products with our hardware.
Sure. Yeah, and that makes sense. It's quite a unique business model, and I applaud you for going down that path. I think it's definitely the way to get these out there in much more volume. All right, Reid, we'll move on. I do have one more topic that I do want to cover off, and I know we are getting a little long here, so we'll try and cover this one off more briefly. I mentioned at the start of the podcast that we'd previously been guests on your own podcast, which was the Do It For A Living podcast. And again, maybe we can drop a link into the show notes that covers the two podcasts Ben and I were on. So why did you start Do It For A Living? Because you ran that for a fair while, sort of side by side with Kaizen Speed. And what did it involve?
Yeah. So podcast got on my radar in 2015 and just wanted to use that as a way, twofold. One of them was selfish, where I wanted to create a good network of people that were at the top of their game and maybe learn from them. And then the other side was pretty altruistic, where I wanted to provide help to those really scary times that I had when we started from fucking nothing. So Do It For A Living was a podcast where we would interview people like yourself starting businesses, where we would go through and we would really try to dig deep on what were the hurdles that you ran into and what was the advice you could give. And hopefully up and coming people could sidestep those things. And the biggest piece of feedback that I got was everyone would say, I had no idea they went through that. Because you don't post all the bullshit. You just post the nice successes and et cetera. And of course, everybody goes through, you know, the difficult, scary stuff too. But man, just that, I still get that feedback now. I had no idea that they went through that. I'm like, yep.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think it would be exactly the same for every business. And, you know, for those who maybe look at where High Performance Academy is at right now, I mean, essentially it's been an overnight success that's been essentially 20 years in the making, because what we do now with High Performance Academy was born out of 13 years of owning and running my own performance shop. So yeah, call that 20 years to get to overnight success status. And
exactly.
You're going to see that with every shop. I know I've listened to a range of the guests that have been on that podcast, and it has been really inspiring. And I think for those who are looking at a career and making a business in this industry, you can start usually with some fairly rose-colored glasses on. The usual sort of path I see, and this is exactly what I went down, is a guy or girl is good at a thing, be that tuning or fabrication or, you know, spinning spanners on a car, and wants to make a business out of what they're good at. And then they get into it and they find that business is actually only maybe 30 to 50% that. And the other 50 to 70% is running the business. And, you know, we see over and again, you know, those who start automotive businesses often are lacking in the business skills side of things. Is that sort of fear? Is that what you sort of experience as well?
100%, because I mean, I came into it reasonably open-eyed. Like I wasn't just fully in love with one particular thing. I was just solving problems as they popped up. But yeah, I mean, the failures of people that I've seen, some of them are incredibly talented at what they do. They just need the framework to be able to only focus on that thing. And sometimes the best in the world at one thing are below average at even average tasks like admin or whatever.
Yeah.
Or even adding things to an invoice, you know, sure.
Yeah. I guess in a nutshell, is there any advice that you would give to those people who are listening to this podcast right now and are considering jumping in with both feet and starting their own business?
So this is a really big one, and it's people. It sounds so cliche, but not just warm bodies, not just people, but the right people. The people that you can get along with, that when you wake up in the morning, you want to go spend time with those people. And then they also have to have the skill sets that you need. So people have been, when I was doing terribly, it's because I had the wrong people on my team. When we do great and things just fall into place, it's because, when I stop and get past the situation, the reason it fell into place is we just had the right people. So you just... And it takes a really long time sometimes, I've tried to identify all the characteristics of the traits that I need for the work that their day-to-day work, but still it fails. Well, why is that? They ticked all the technical boxes. Well, it's because they didn't see my vision. We didn't get along. We didn't understand the world in the same way.
That's an excellent answer that I don't think too many people maybe consider. And through my business experience so far, I 100% see exactly that. Every time I've been in a situation where we've been struggling and we've sort of ended up with an unenjoyable work environment, it's often been as a result of a staff member that's been a bad fit. And it's tricky because you look through a CV, a resume, and on paper, they're excellent at the technical job. I would actually say that their ability to do the technical job is often less important than their fit with the culture that you're trying to build. And I can't emphasize enough how important culture is, because if you don't have a place where everyone is on the same page, pumped about the journey you're on and enjoying coming to work in the morning, it's not going to end well. So I always say that the technical skill or technical capability of a new hire for me is less important than that person's fit with the business, because obviously you're not going to employ an idiot just because they're nice to hang around with. But if you've got someone with the right mindset and technical capability, you can train them to do the technical side of the job, but you cannot change a person's mindset, I don't believe, if they're not a good fit for your culture.
Yeah, and so it's got to be both.
Yeah.
So it's got to be, they have to be technically proficient and a fit.
And that's harder to find a culture than it sounds.
100%. So the only way that we've found it is to spend time with those people. And I've found that it takes more than 3 months even. I've found in my experience, it's about 6 months before I really get a feel for how we're going to go through things together, how we're going to go through the highs, how we're going to go through the lows, how they're going to interpret things. So we just try now. I actually just hired a guy yesterday. And we tried to lay out, and we had multiple interviews, and we tried to just spend some time and shoot the shit. And more importantly, I try to make it a little bit uncomfortable and see how they react to that. And those are just the real low hurdles. And now we just laid out the expectation that, look, it's going to be 6 months before we know if this is going to work or not.
Sure.
And yeah, so we actually make it kind of, if we find somebody that we like, we maybe want them to, I wouldn't say jump through some hoops, but I want to go through the shit with you. Elbow to elbow, I want to go through the shit with you and find out, you'll find out who I am and I'll find out who you are, and we'll build the team.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, Reid, let's move towards wrapping this thing up. And we've got the same questions we ask every guest. The first of those is, what's next for you and Kaizen Speed in the future? What's on your radar?
Product design. Just going hard in product design and trying to see the Kaizen Relay through to everything that I have, that I want for it. So yeah, I'm still 4 years in now. I'm still super stoked and proud and moving forward with lots of different things. So we're just just running like crazy, trying to create products that use Kaizen Relays.
Yeah, awesome.
So that product design, both with that and with the other brand. So
yep. No, I mean it's
products.
Yep. Sounds like a good focus. In terms of your journey so far and everything you've learned, the highs and lows along the way, is there any advice that you'd give to a younger version of yourself, maybe to fast track your progress?
Just chill the fuck out. Like, I have a tendency to, because I'm like, my mom used to always say, patience is a virtue. And then I would always mutter under my breath that I don't have.
Yeah.
Right. So, I got to just chill.
I think that is great advice. That is really easy to overlook. I mean, particularly in the automotive industry, it's a pretty fast-paced industry. You can end up under a lot of pressure, and sometimes you do have to just take a step back, take a breath, and sort of look at the big picture and understand where you are and where you're going. And having a bit of patience, I'm not the most patient person, I'll admit, but it is something that I need to work more on. So yeah, great point to bring up. Our last question for today, if people listening want to find out a little bit more about you, maybe they want to purchase 100,000 Kaizen Relays, where can they go to? Where should they follow you along?
KaizenSpeed.com, K-A-I-Z, like zebra, enspeed.com, kaizenrelay.com. Our Honda brand is KS Tuned, so kstuned.com, and then at KS Tuned and at Kaizen Speed on all the platforms.
Perfect. Again, we'll chuck some links into the show notes that people can follow if they didn't understand your accent, but that was pretty clear, I think. thanks a lot for the time you've given us today, Reid. It's been a really interesting podcast, and it's probably gone a little bit longer than our usual ones, but there was just so much great detail in there. I just thought that we needed to keep going, and I'm hopeful that our listeners will get a huge amount of value out of that and learn from your experiences.
Yeah, I hope so.
All right. All the best.
Thanks a lot. Thank you so much.
All right, that concludes our interview. And before we sign off, I just wanted to mention, for anyone who's been perhaps hiding under a rock and hasn't heard of High Performance Academy before, we are an online training school and we specialize in teaching a range of performance automotive topics, everything from engine tuning and engine building through to wiring, car suspension and wheel alignment, data analysis and race driver education. Now, remember, you've got that coupon code. You can use podcast75 at the checkout to get $75 off the purchase of your first course. You'll find our full course list at hpacademy.com/courses. Important to mention that when you purchase a course from us, that course is yours for life as well. It never expires. You can rewatch the course as many times as you like, whenever you like. The purchase of a course will also give you 3 months of access to our gold membership. That gives you access to our private members only forum, which is the perfect place to get answers to your specific questions. You'll also get access to our regular weekly members webinars, which is where we touch on a particular topic in the performance automotive realm. We dive into that topic for about an hour. If you can watch live, you can ask questions and get answers in real time. If the time zones don't work for you, that's fine too. You're going to get access as a gold member to our previous webinar archive. We've got close to 300 hours of existing content in that archive. It is an absolute goldmine. So remember that coupon code podcast75. Check out our course list at hpacademy.com/courses.